This is the Mark Krasinovich Countdown Show.
You got it. And we're here waiting to see Mark Hurley coming out of his last activity. And you guys are going to talk about some really cool stuff. You've already got three sheets with the questions you got to ask.
And we've got a whole bunch of stuff lined up on Twitter. Make sure you tweet us, hashtag CH9Live right there. Yeah, you want to tweet us for more questions with Mark Krasinovich, who will be here shortly. Yep. We made an audible.
In case you don't know, I am not Mark Krasinovich.
The hat gave it away.
I'm the regular IT guy. I'm just Rick. That's all.
So for those of you who are sticking with us through the entire Learn Windows Azure event, stay tuned. We still have one more session coming up on data with Quentin Clark.
Yes.
So you're going to want to hang out for that. And, of course, tweet your questions to hashtag CH9Live for Mark Krasinovich, who will be here shortly, who's involved in 1.5 million other things like the rest of us.
Busy guy. The, you know, personal assistants, they're all coordinating where he goes and what he does. Like, I'd love to have that.
It's awesome. You don't have a personal assistant?
No, I don't.
I think you need to write that into your writer.
My personal assistant is my Nokia phone.
Is your Nokia phone? That's awesome. That's awesome. So I want to talk about the rest of TechEd. I mean, we kind of covered today what we've already done.
Yep.
So since we have a few minutes, for those of you who are sticking around at home, tomorrow we've got another keynote.
Day 2 keynote is going to be focusing on the client experience.
Focused on Windows, baby.
Yes, Windows.
It's on Windows.
The other side of the house. I'm, you know, server guy, client side of thing. Hey, wait a second. I'm server guy?
Client guy?
You're kind of client guy? This is funny.
Exactly.
Day 1, day 2.
Exactly where I want it to be. So that's day 2 tomorrow, 8:30 a.m.
Live stream once
Eastern
again.
Time. That means if you're in the Pacific time zone, like where I'm normally from.
Yeah, that's 6 a.m.
Get up really early.
Yeah. But that's you will be able to see it again later, actually. Right? On demand?
Yeah, absolutely. You can catch everything on demand along with the sessions.
Yes.
So if you miss sessions, including the sessions from the Learn Windows Azure event that we've got going on, that we are just right in a break, another break, you'll be able to catch those on demand as well. And then, following the keynote, we're going to be back right here for Channel 9 Live. We're going to do another keynote after party tomorrow. And then we've got a ton of live sessions that you can catch from the Taste of TechEd, just like we've done today. And then we will be live through all of the breaks. We've got awesome guests.
Yep.
I'm super fired up because I'm going to be doing an Active Directory talk with Dean Wells.
Yeah, well, I've got Woolsey.
You've got Jeff Woolsey. You're going to talk Hyper-V.
Hyper-V. It's going to be awesome, absolutely awesome. I could talk with Jeff for hours. I'm sure he doesn't want to talk with me for hours, but I could talk with Jeff for hours, absolutely.
And then, of course, we also have a special episode of The Ed Show.
Okay.
That we're going to do. We're going to do a little bit of Ed Show tomorrow and a wrap-up of all the things that have been going on here with Channel 9 Live at TechEd North America 2012. Orlando.
No, I just want to point out, we mentioned that you can see recorded sessions after the fact. And in case people don't know, if you go to the TechEd website, northamerica.teched.microsoft.com, you can go in and view the sessions, view the session catalogs, take a look at the resources, look at the PowerPoints. And within 24, 48 hours of the session going live, usually there's a video that you can be able to see as well of the session. And so I found that in the past, for those of you that are in the online environment right now, I found that helpful in the past to be able to still get my TechEd fix while I'm not at the venue. I am able to go in and to see those.
And even for folks who are actually maybe watching this even after the event, if you were here, it's often a challenge where you're like, you build your schedule and there's like sessions that you want to see at the exact same time, and they haven't figured out how to clone you.
My personal data assistant of the Nokia actually has me triple booked in some and quadruple booked in a couple, so I'm definitely going to be catching some stuff recorded.
Yeah, so it's a great place to go get your fix of all the TechEd information, catch those sessions that you had to miss, or maybe, and this is what I found, there are some of these sessions that you look at and you go, yeah, I'm not really too sure about, and then all of a sudden, through the buzz of the internet and through the world of Twitter, you find out, this was one of the best sessions that they had at TechEd.
Oh, yeah.
And you can go back and catch that.
Yep. Very, very handy.
So we've got all sorts of amazing stuff coming up. And it's only the first day. It is only the first day.
I got a question for you. How do you pace yourself? Like, you know, we were talking about during the Camptown show how many TechEds we've been to. You outclassed me by the number of TechEds attended. I outclassed you for the earlier TechEd attended.
Correct. I was
15 years ago.
Right.
But you've been to a number of them, both from an attendee perspective, from someone working the event, and also someone working for Microsoft. How do you pace yourself, dude?
It's a skill that's just been honed over years, right? you have to learn not to completely overdo yourself on both fronts, right? There's obviously the social aspect. We talk about this a lot in the Countdown show. This is the place you want to be to network, whether you're a developer, an IT pro, even both. Several of the events that they've got going on, both just during the daytime and the evening, You can go to sessions, fill your head full of all of this stuff. The other thing that I learned that really helped me is the hands-on lab experience.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Being able to take some time out, sit down in front of a machine, put some of this knowledge that I have gained to work. And then, you know, getting out, talking to some of the partners. And then we've got all these lounges around here.
Mm-hmm.
Take 5, 10 minutes, 20 minutes, and just give yourself a break.
Yeah, no, I know there's a couple of things I haven't checked out yet. There's the Retro Arcade Lounge that's just down the hall there. You can actually play Centipede with the trackball, which is very, very nice.
Do they have pinball? Like
they have pinball there. They've got the old rollerball to be able to get the ball up into the hoop, get some carnival games.
Oh, the skee ball. The
skee ball's there.
Yeah.
My favorite, I think I'm going to challenge you to, but I think I might lose, is the bubble hockey. Be able to go and play hockey directly on there, eh?
I take your challenge.
You know, you got work to do here. I'll wait till you're done talking with Mark.
Do they have pinball? But,
they have pinball too.
Are you sure I have to sit here and talk about it? If there's pinball, man, I should just.
And you know, there's also really cool events and stuff like that going on. But you know, I haven't had a chance yet to go off and see the Project Detroit Mustang. It's here. Also,
absolutely.
There's a Porsche up right behind us.
I don't know if you can see it in
the camera angle. I haven't quite figured out the Porsche out yet, but I got to figure that one out. And then some of the partners also have some cool stuff. I got to go sit on the Ducati Monster.
Awesome, awesome. Again, just to remind those of you who are sitting at home, you're listening to Rick and I talk as we are doing the Mark Rusinovich countdown for Tech in North America 2012.
Second edition.
Hashtag CH9Live. Get those questions queued up. I'm already seeing a ton of them up there. We want more. We're going to talk to Mark not only about Azure Infrastructure as a Service, because we got into this conversation.
Mm-hmm.
We started talking about a lot of stuff. I had to cut him off because it was time to go off to the next session.
Yeah.
Quentin Clark will be coming up shortly, so stay tuned for those of you who are viewing. I'm going to also talk to Mark beyond the Windows Azure aspect of things.
Mm-hmm.
And so stick around for that. We're going to talk about his book, talk about cisternals. You can't have Mark up here and not talk about cisternals tools,
no,
right?
Absolutely, man. That's probably one of the most popular attended sessions for any tech ed. And even internal conference that I've seen Mark speak at is those internal sessions and also the deep dive troubleshooting ones. Like you go into those ones and your brain starts to bleed. It's insane, absolutely insane.
While we're hanging out and waiting, we've talked a lot today. We've got the Learn Windows Azure session going on.
Mm-hmm.
Talking to you, who's just coming from the same background that I had, I mean, let's be honest, we're both server huggers.
Yeah.
We openly admit that we are complete and total server
huggers,
right? I'm
a card-carrying member and a button-pin member.
And a button-pin member. What is it about the cloud, or are there things about the cloud that inspire you, that make you excited, or are there things that unnerve you about the cloud?
I'll go with the inspire first. I'm more of a positive kind of guy. So for me, the inspiring part about the cloud, what I'm looking to, what I want to aspire to be able to bring into most organizations, is the automation, because it makes mm-hmm. my job easier, which means I can go home and I can see my kids and my family earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the level of simplicity that brings the automation comes. It removes that level of human error that's there. I say the word human error, and this is Mr. Claus, Rick, talking here.
Where clausing something is actually an adjective.
Clausing something has become an adjective inside the Urban Dictionary. But this level of automation for what you can do with it is fantastic. I do that once, I can now just repeat and repeat and repeat, and then have it go and keep that away inside my little floppy disk or USB drive full of scripts and PowerShell commandments, that sort of stuff. So definitely that's my aspiration, is to be able to have that level of automation. Server 2012, little plug there. Obviously, allows you to get to that point mm-hmm. with the server operating system. So absolutely phenomenal where that goes. Little hesitation, quite honestly, for me, has been, because I tend to be a little bit of a server hugger, is the fact that I can't just touch my systems. But you said something with Mark's earlier interview that was very comforting to me, was the fact that the VMs just sit inside Azure Blob Storage, and you can get them out again. That's
right.
Awesome, because that's not the way with other vendors, other solutions. So literally, I'm not selling the farm and being done with it. I'm literally, okay, well, this one's looking good. I want to go up and move this into there, try it out, boom, it works. And then I want to go production with it. Awesome, it's great. But then for some unforeseen reason, if I do decide I need to move it, you can. So that makes it very comforting for me, the fact that it's just simply a VM inside storage for the IaaS stuff that you guys are talking about.
Well, and you just mentioned that it's just a VM.
Yeah, it's
and this well that's a great thing, right? I mean, especially around Hyper-V.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I've been so excited since we started talking about the new spring release features with Azure Infrastructure as a Service, the thing the session Mark just did right before he came down and joined us out there. It's just a virtual machine. It's really, it's Hyper-V. And the great thing, and he showed this in the keynote, when he went to build an image and to build a Hyper-V machine, right there is it's Windows Server. It's right there. So you're not having to completely rethink. I think that's one of the, there are some additional skills that you need to gain and some additional knowledge and thinking around dealing with cloud. Mm-hmm. But you're not having to completely rethink everything when you start looking to move to the cloud.
Yeah, I mean, you can transport some of your skills over, obviously, and then simply tweak and tune. And that's something that you've been doing in the industry, if you've been working in the industry for any length of time, you've been doing that almost every year with different product releases of different things that you support. So it's a different mindset. I can definitely say that I've been warming up to the whole concept an awful lot more. I'm very excited about the IaaS offering that's now available. It looks awesome from what you can do with it. I can't wait to try it myself because, quite honestly, I haven't had a chance to yet. And so I understand you guys, we are. Oh yeah, I work for Microsoft.
You forget who you work for?
We are making options available to be able to go off in and try it, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Do you have any details on that? Azure. Are they soon? Can you talk about this yet?
Right now.
So I'm not scooping Mark on this.
No. Right? We did actually talk about it with Mark. So Azure.com. Go sign up. They Mark gave us some late breaking news in his last time that he was there that he didn't have any there wasn't anybody sitting around on a wait list and anything, so you can go ahead and do it. Get in there, try it out, get some good stuff going.
I won't do it yet because I'll let other people try. It's
probably a good thing.
It's for the public, it's not for me internally.
That's probably a really, really good idea. All right, so the folks who are hanging out listening to Rick and I banter about. We are live at TechEd North America 2012 in Orlando, Florida. Mark Krasinovich is, I see him over there waiting in the wings. So tweet your questions, hashtag CH9Live. I am looking at a monitor that has a whole bunch of questions on it.
Yeah.
We have room for more. We will take your questions at home. I've got some questions for Mark. And
can you ask that one there for me?
That one right there?
That's going to be good.
Okay, yeah, I'll absolutely make sure to ask him for that. Yeah. Remember, if you are watching the Learn Windows Azure event, which you should be, and if you're just tuning into this after the show, go back and watch Learn Windows Azure. Quentin Clark's coming up next to talk about data. Data seems to be a theme today.
It's a big thing. It's a big transition in the industry. Big data, learning lots of stuff, lots of people.
Yeah,
Jeffrey,
absolutely.
Jeffrey had some good talks about that.
I mentioned that when I was having a chat with Jeffrey, is just taking, there's so much data that gets collected on a day-to-day business that's running.
Yep.
Take that, analyze it, be able to do things with it.
Untap.
And that's really kind of that next trend, that absolute next trend. Mm-hmm. So there is a question from at STE Hulse,
Steel Hulse.
Many concepts introduced with Windows Azure. How do I get an overview and understand these concepts? I have the answer.
You're not Mark, though.
Oh, I know I'm not Mark, but I can actually answer the question.
Okay.
Do you know where to go get this information?
I don't. You should tell me.
We have a whole ton of online training information about the spring release, and you want to go check it out.
Oh,
there's
that's
some labs that you
now?
Can run through. Yeah, absolutely. In fact, it was available on Friday.
I did not know that.
So
I stand
Windows,
corrected.
You want to check out Windows Azure.com for all that information. Of course, you can go through rewatch the Learn Windows Azure sessions.
Nice.
And then you can gain some of that knowledge. And we're just hanging out, waiting for Mark. Tweet your questions hashtag CH9Live. Guess what, buddy? I see you standing over there. You know what I'm going to do again?
You're going to kick me out?
Get out.
Okay. I'll get him.
Hey, sorry. Rick's going to love me. I keep doing this. Rick's going to love you now, Mark.
I kick him out.
That's all right. Sure. Thanks for the audible and dropping back by again.
Sure.
Because we started down a path
in
chatting about things and networking and all these other things, and my brain starts going 100 million miles an hour, and I've got questions, and I think you can see that over there. We have a ton of questions from our viewers. You're a popular guy, apparently.
Why is that?
Well, because of all the questions that we've got there, you've been dragged back and forth from here, there, and the other. And more water.
More water.
Yeah, grab a drink there.
Anonymous.
Anonymous water. Yeah. Yes, it's anonymous water. We were talking about networks when we got rudely interrupted to have to go back to the Learn Windows Azure event.
Yeah.
One of the questions that I've kind of heard buzzing around, I've been asked as we do some the early talks around Windows Azure, virtual networks versus service bus.
Uh-huh.
When do I choose? What do I choose? How do I get my head around the different networking options that are there?
So a really good question. So the virtual network technology is IP-based networking.
Okay.
So you're going to want to use that if you've got existing applications that talk IP, talk TCP, talk UDP, talk ICMP. That's what that's designed for. Service bus is a PaaS. It's a PaaS middleware platform or service. So if you got applications that want to talk across different sites, want to talk to on-premise without having to set up a VPN gateway, and want to use REST APIs to do that, then that's where Service Bus fits in.
Okay.
So for example, if I want to connect my on-premise with the cloud through a secure IP tunnel to basically bring the cloud into my intranet, I'm going to use virtual networks. If I want to talk over the open internet through a REST API between something running on-premise and something in the cloud, so there are new applications written to this API, then I use Service Bus.
Okay. So there's the old school way, and there's the new school
way. Well, it's actually not old and new. It actually, the Service Bus does a lot more than just message delivery. Like, IP delivers packets, right?
Right.
But Service Bus is actually a queuing system, pub/sub, notification, so it's got a lot of richer services that you don't get out of TCP, for example.
Okay. You talked about connecting to my internal network.
Yeah. Your internal network? I don't want to connect to your internal network.
You talk about connecting from the public cloud to my own private cloud, my own company's network that we have, network infrastructure there, and we talk about using that secure VPN. This is hybrid. This is hybrid cloud,
It is hybrid cloud, yeah. That's what we call it.
I want to talk about various hybrid cloud options that we have. One of the things that scares a lot of people when they're just dipping their toes in the water of cloud, they're like, I'm not really sure that I trust putting everything up there.
Right.
What are my options in terms of deployment schemes when I'm looking at applications that I'm deploying out, cloud, on-premise, combination of both?
Yep. It's a really common question. People look at it and say, I don't want to move the whole thing up there. I've got assets or data that I want to keep within my own data center. And there's a few reasons you might want that. For one is, I've got the bulk of my enterprise applications accessing that data, so it actually makes sense to have that data closer to those compute resources that are accessing it. I want to extend it up into the cloud, but I'll leave the whole thing, there's a ton of it there, I don't want to migrate the whole thing, I'll leave it on-premise, and then create a hybrid scenario where something up in the cloud is reaching back in to get that data. And the other reason I might want to keep it on-premise or in my own data center is I've got compliance or regulatory requirements around how that data is actually managed. So I've got data center physical security policies and auditing of the software that's touching that and the people that are touching it that I don't get when I go to a public cloud.
Right.
I get the certifications that the public cloud's got, like we've got ISO 27001 for Windows Azure Storage. Maybe you need some other kind of certification for your data. So you then leave the data on-premise, put the compute up in the cloud and have it connect back securely to get at the data when it needs to.
And it's really kind of a great way for me to just kind of get started, right? I can put some things up there, feel comfortable, and then start moving
and
up
more.
And as
you know, we're going to get more certifications compliance, people get more trust in the cloud, the bulk of the data starts being created up in the cloud, so it's not, the center of gravity starts moving to the cloud, and then it's natural to start focusing on building a route out around that.
Awesome, awesome. Tweet your question. We've got Mark Krasinovich here. We're just heading out in just a few minutes to Quentin Clark. Actually, about 20 minutes. We've got plenty of time to talk. We've got questions from hashtag CH9Live. Dan Kreitz writes, are cloud services going to be the next utility company?
Actually, it's pretty much it. I mean, it is kind of utility computing. We talk about dial tone. We talk about the old telephone system, right? Mm-hmm. You pick up the phone, you just expect it to be on and reliable. And that's the way that cloud services are becoming. At least the infrastructure services, I mean, Windows Azure Storage just needs to always be there, working, humming along reliably. And so there's two aspects to that utility company. One is commoditization, and the other one is high scale and high availability, reliability. I just addressed the high availability, high reliability. Now, the commoditization aspect of it, yes, I think that these lower level services like storage and basic compute
will be commoditized as well and become, just assume that it's there and I can go get it from different people in different ways. What you're going to see differentiation happen is higher up the stack and also in levels of SLA around the around it. So, for example, if I've got utility computing, which is the phone system, now we're moving into wireless, right? Mm-hmm. So the level of service I get out of wireless is less. Now, what if I wanted enterprise-grade wireless service? So there's some company out there that's willing to invest in, I'm putting cell towers that have certain capabilities, and I'm not going to over-provision to the extent that the consumer-facing, cell phone towers are deployed. I can start selling that to people that really want a higher degree of reliability around their wireless service. You can see the same thing happen in the cloud. Storage services, for example. Certain latency and certain number of IOs per second you get at some basic level. And then if you want massive IOPS, if you want very short latencies, then you buy into higher degrees of higher levels of service, to opt into that.
Sounds like my cable TV subscription.
So it is kind of like that. And so that's kind of the way that I see things going. At the bottom, it's pretty much basic utility services, but then you start to get into more enterprise grade, higher levels of service, and then even higher services like Windows Azure Active Directory. It's something that a lot of people won't, a lot of applications might not use much of the functionality, but then there's things like being able to connect to Office 365 and single sign-on and things like that that you start to buy into those kinds of features mm-hmm. when you want them, enterprise features.
But those base common features, like picking up the phone and hearing
the
dial tone, that storage, that compute, that networking,
yep.
that's there.
For
that's
sure,
on.
Yeah.
Awesome. Let's grab a couple more questions from hashtag CH9Live on the Twitter. Ben Foster Dev, are there plans to allow Azure websites to connect to cloud services on a VNet, like a SQL server running inside of a VM?
Yep. So are there any plans for that? Not at the moment.
Okay.
We've talked about it. There's lots of intricacies in wiring websites that are running inside of VMs securely to other VMs, because the VNet concept is a VM-based concept. So basically, you got to control the access coming out of a slice of a VM, which is what a website is,
right?
In Windows Azure website, and having that website be able to talk, but not the guy next door to him talk out.
Sure.
So there's,
And we talked to Satya even mentioned this a little bit in the keynote that talks about this. I want to be able to access all of my stuff, but to have multi-tenancy and to have that separation.
Yeah.
Seems like I'm asking for my cake and eating it too. Almost.
Kind of. I mean, it's theoretically possible. It's just a matter of a lot of engineering work, and the question is how many people really want to take advantage
sure.
of that, because you can always migrate up into if you're in a website, maybe the next step is migrating up into an extra small VM. Mm-hmm. If you want to get into, I care about it, SQL database that's actually separate. The other thing, too, is that you can always, even with what we've got today, create a SQL Azure cloud SQL Server cloud service.
Mm-hmm.
It's got a public endpoint. You won't be able to, it'll be on the internet, but you'll still access it through your front end and authenticate it to it. It's not as quite as secure as what he's talking about with VNets, but it's still possible.
I've got some stuff here that I've heard you talk about, and I want to bring up here today, where we start talking about high availability.
Yeah.
Talking about the various things that we have inside the Windows Azure platform. You talked a lot in your chat today. We talk about the various ways that we split things up so that we have availability and load balancing. Talk about the internals of that. How do we almost guarantee the service levels that we have?
Well, one of the concepts that we got, and it's been there from the very start, is something called a fault domain. So if you look at a data center architecture, the way that servers are connected up to the network and to power and control from automated control, it's not economical to create redundancy everywhere, because that's one of the keys to high availability is redundancy. So
right.
The data center routers at the entrance to the data centers, really critical that those are highly available, so we've got redundancy there. These massive routers, there's two of them, so there's failover if one fails. When you get out into racks, it's not economically feasible to put two top-of-rack routers in each rack, because not only does that mean you got two top-of-rack routers, but now you've got pairs of wires coming from pairs of NICs in each server to get up to each one of them. And so now you've just doubled the cost of a rack almost. You don't have to duplicate the compute, but everything else you've doubled. Same thing with power, same thing with, So we've got single points of failure that just are economically make sense to have in the data center. Now, to make it possible for applications to survive a failure of any one of those non-redundant components, we've come up with this concept called fault domains, which is a rack. Okay. Today, that's the single point of failure, the top of rack router, the power in the rack, the network in the rack. So we call each one a fault domain, and we make sure that your VMs, if they're part of a role in the PaaS world or part of an availability set in the virtual machine world, that we spread them across fault domains so that if we do have a failure there, which is just inevitable. I mean, it is hardware, no matter...
It's going to happen, who,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, no matter who you are, you put hardware down, it's going to fail at some point. So when that happens, not impacting your entire application, just a part of it.
Right.
And then we automatically heal the application. We call it service healing. This will happen whether it's a virtual machine or a PaaS web role. We'll take that VM and move it onto a healthy server on a healthy rack automatically.
You do some really cool stuff in some of your sessions where we actually get to go in and kind of take a look at this.
Yeah, and actually on Wednesday I'm doing an Azure internal session where, again, I'll be doing it. And it's fun to, you know, there's a what we call the dog food cluster, which is our test cluster. There's no production stuff in it. Nobody's, you know, no sensitive data in it. And people expect it to be flaky because we're testing new things in there. And so I can go right into a node and kill it. And I'm like, there's other VMs on there besides mine, but oh well.
Yeah.
And then I show what, you know, snapshots of the data center. Viewer showing that.
Do you ever
happen.
Just kind of get the evil laugh, kind of rub your hands together and go, I have it, server. I have all of the power.
That server is mine.
I had a question that I've had asked actually just last night in talking to some customers. Talk about the differentiation between a Hyper-V farm and what we offer in Windows Azure with these VMs.
Yeah. Differentiation. So there's different design points. A Hyper-V farm is designed to scale from very small number of servers up to, say, 1,000.
Mm-hmm.
Scales really well. What Windows Azure's design point is massive scale. So 1,000 servers is kind of the low end, 500 servers. That's the design point in that. And also, we've got homogeneous data center hardware. We've got homogeneous topology of the network. And we've got this application model and this store these services that we know are going to be there, like Windows Azure Storage, that we can, they're just there, they're part of the foundation. So that allows us a lot of optimizations in Windows Azure that you can't easily get on Hyper-V farms. For example, if you want some shared storage for your virtual machine images in a Hyper-V farm, you create a SAN, right? A shared storage solution, highly scale it out yourself, you worry about the redundancy management of this thing, and whereas we've already built that with Windows Azure Storage, so we just put the VM images there. So things like that just kind of differentiate the two.
Awesome. Awesome. It's good for folks to know. Again, for those of you who are watching at home, tweet us. That's hashtag CH9Live. So we've got a couple of questions here. Let's go to Miguel Lopez. How is SQL 2012 VM I/O capacity and shared cloud services versus on-premises or a shared environment? Does it interfere with processing?
Okay, so that's a really good question, and that is a place where we're getting more sophisticated about multi-tenancy and resource isolation. So it's really critical that we deliver consistent performance in the cloud. I mean, and this is kind of a learning over time. I think that the way that if you look at enterprise multi-tenancy, if you look at multi-tenancy in enterprise, it's what we call enterprise multi-tenancy now. This is it's kind of natural, I guess. It's obvious you would call it that.
Named that? It's brilliant.
So I came up with the name. Thank you. And what that means is that you've got a shared resource like an Active Directory domain controller or a SQL server with multiple tenants, meaning different applications hitting the marketing guys and the sales guys are both hitting this thing. One of them, the IT staff for that department writes something that goes crazy and starts hammering the SQL server and the performance sucks and the marketing guys are like, what the hell is going on? Well, the IT staff calls up the developers and says, you screwed up, you got a bug, fix it. That's enterprise multi-tenancy, which is more friendly, more cooperative. You've got, mechanisms. If you get some rogue employee that denial of service attacks the SQL server, you figure out where it came from, you do an investigation, and then you take the guy and you fire him or even call the police, right?
Right.
That's very different than the environment that we operate in the cloud, in the public cloud, which we call hostile multi-tenancy.
Okay.
It's hostile because you can get people that you don't know who they are, they're anonymous, and they might just want to cause trouble. And when that happens, somebody's causing trouble, like I want to denial of service attack something, we can't necessarily call law enforcement and make them stop. In fact, it's probably damaging our business if we let them succeed, because they're impacting other people that are running their businesses on us. And it's not like we can say, oh, we're all one big happy family, you know, we fixed it, let's move on. They're like, what the hell?
Yeah.
So the only way to protect against that and deliver a service in a hostile multi-tenant environment is to do good resource isolation. So this is an area, like I said, where we're evolving and coming up with new platform features and functionality to make it easier for us to isolate resources, monitor resources, get control of resources. Does a couple things. I talked to it first of all addresses this interference problem, and actually we've been doing pretty large scale tests of hammering Windows Azure Storage from Windows Azure SQL VMs to look at the behavior of the system and making tweaks here and there to make it perform more consistently. But the second is, like I mentioned, this higher levels of service. This also lets us get into that. If we can control resource utilization and govern it, then we can say, you want X number of IOPS, you're signed up for this. You want higher number of IOPS, you're signed up for this. We still over-provision, but we know that the bulk of the people are going to be at the basic, and we provision enough resource to get the number of people that want the higher level of service in there so that we can satisfy their needs, you know, and make everybody happy and deliver them consistent performance. Really, I think this is one of the fascinating parts of developing a hostile multi-tenant service to me, is because these are really hard problems. You get your efficiencies with a cloud by over-provisioning, meaning I get a sample size of people and I know you're not all going to hit the database at the same time. Mm-hmm. What happens if you decide to all hit at the same time? How do we deal with that? How do we maintain SLAs? What should the SLAs be, assuming the basic level of performance that people are going to want and expect, and then how do we tier it? And so, it's, like I said, a lot of fun going and solving these kinds of problems.
Sounds awesome. I'm completely fascinated sitting here and listening to you. Yeah. We got more questions on Twitter. At Eshi says, it seems that capturing an image from a virtual machine doesn't include the data disk. We talked about data disk earlier. Yeah. Is there a way to create an image with separate data disks?
Another really good question. So let me talk about what capture really does. Capture is aimed at taking an OS disk and putting it in an image gallery, in your own private image gallery. So the reason why you want to do that, let me talk about platform images, your images, and disks.
Okay.
So platform images, these are generalized images that we've created or partners have created and we've put and made available to you. So in the VM creation wizard, you can go pick them.
Like the best one ever.
Yeah, exactly. And then when you go create a virtual machine, you take one of those generalized images, we make a copy for you, and then you boot the VM off it and specialize it. So it gets the computer name that you wanted and the admin password that you wanted, and now it's a disk. A disk is an instantiated virtual machine. It's specialized. So you get this collection of disks now. Some of them are OS disks, and some of them are data disks.
Right.
The OS disks started out as platform images generally, someplace in their lifetime. Even if you migrated it from on-premise, at some point it was a generalized Windows image that you then pushed up into the cloud. Now, the case of what capture does is you take one of those instantiated OS disks in a VM, and you say, I want to capture it. What that does is shuts it down, sysprep generalize, and now that goes in your image gallery.
That's my master disk.
That's your master disk.
Image,
it's
right?
Your master image. Now you clone it, right? And
okay.
Then create virtual machines from it, and then they go through sysprep specialize to become disks, you know, to create disks off of that.
Okay.
So the reason why we don't capture the data disks, you don't need to do that. If you want to have that data disk used by other VMs, you simply copy it. There's no need to generalize it and put it in the image gallery. You basically just use it.
Right. Okay.
Or copy it. You know?
Right. It's a little different than where I'm trying to replicate my whole environment to redeploy.
That's right. It's not. It's aimed at image creation versus VM cloning. You know,
gotcha. All right. Makes sense. At MC Todd, is there such a thing as an on-premise PaaS running Azure Server?
An on-premise PaaS.
I hear this all the time.
Yeah. So if you look at PaaS, what we've got, web roles, worker roles, we don't have a direct on-premise version of those. The closest we come is web role, where the web role in its purest sense is an ASP.NET website. So you can launch that in IIS on-premise. Mm-hmm. And actually, I showed in my session this afternoon, taking a ASP.NET website and promoting it to become a web role in a cloud service, simply using the Visual Studio wizard to say, create cloud service and make this ASP.NET website the web role for it. So in some sense, we do have that level of consistency across the two. When it comes to the runtime compute pass features that you get when you deploy it into Windows Azure, you get this agent in there that's heart beating with you. It's also just, you're able to deploy certificates into it. You're deploy configuration into it that you can read through runtime APIs. We don't have that on-premise and server. We're looking right now at what makes sense to take back onto on-server so that there's more consistency in programming models between the two. But today, that's kind of the line between.
Fair enough. For those of you at home, we are waiting. We're just going to chat with Mark for a few more minutes, and then Quentin Clark's going to come next for the Learn Windows Azure event. Tweet your questions, hashtag CH9Live. I would sit and talk about Azure all day long. Of course, that's what
that's
I get
awesome.
For being the evangelist for Windows Azure to the IT pros. There's a couple more things that I wanted to chat with you about, because it would be remiss if I didn't talk about some cisternal stuff and other things. But I've read Zero Day. Actually, as a matter of fact, I read it again on the plane.
That's so awesome.
I read it again on the plane. And here's why. There's this virus. Right?
Yep.
Or malware has come out with, which is Flame.
Yep.
And when I initially started reading it, I was like, I've heard of something there's something similar in Mark's book.
Yeah.
And I went back through and I reread it. Talk a little bit about, I mean, obviously you had this idea when you created the book and you kind of went down this path, and I'm not going to, but talk about the malware and some of these things and really kind of those things. You've got a session coming up that kind of came out of your mind that were the basis of the book. I know you have a follow-up book coming up as well. Talk a little bit about some of those things.
So the book that you're referring to, Zero Day, was a book that I actually came up with back in 2005, finished it in 2006. It took me forever to get it agent and then published, and it came out March of last year.
Yep.
Sold really, really well. In fact, I'd started on a second book hoping that it would, and after it proved itself, the publisher picked up the second book. It's called Trojan Horse. We'll be out in September. I'll be giving away, I got the advanced reviewers copies, or advanced reader copies, so they're softbound, uncorrected versions of the book. I'm going to give one away in my session tomorrow.
Awesome.
But
I'll be there. Am I eligible?
Yeah,
sure. I'm going to try.
I haven't figured out the criteria for giving it away. It might be some cybersecurity trivia question or something.
Oh, okay, you get me on that one.
Yeah. Actually, Trojan Horse is actually much more in line with what this Flame malware is, which is government-sponsored cyber espionage, almost certainly. It's not, we don't know for sure, although the U.S. government basically admitted a couple weeks ago that they were in a New York Times article with sources that we were behind Stuxnet, which was a malware very similar to Flame, advanced capabilities, very clearly targeted at Iranian nuclear program and the centrifuges there. That was discovered in July of 2010. Flame was discovered, people believe it's been circulating for several years, two or three years, without being discovered.
Wow.
It's different than Stuxnet in that it's not going after SCADA systems or supervisory control and acquisition data systems like Stuxnet was, but it looks like it's espionage. It knows how to turn on the webcam and record you, look for Bluetooth devices. It's got pluggable module system. It looks like a serious engineering effort. It took advantage of a very advanced crypto attack that people hadn't seen before on Microsoft code signing certificates, so it could look like it was signed by Microsoft. So some pretty high power stuff behind this thing. Obviously, it looks, if you're going to say where it was found too, was mostly in the Middle East with a high predominance of discovery of findings in Iran again. So.
Right.
Signs point to it's probably related to Stuxnet, and probably that means the U.S. and Israel behind it. Now, the Trojan Horse book that's coming out, so Zero Day was talking about just what could you do if you were just a terrorist? You just wanted to cause havoc. So nothing.
I didn't want to get on an airplane to come down here, dude.
Don't start reading the book if you get on an airplane. The first few chapters are going to cause you problems.
Yeah, a little bit there.
Yeah, and actually, people don't know that there was a Spanair flight a few years ago that crashed because the systems that monitor the avionics were run off mainframes, and one of the mainframes had gotten infected with a piece of malware that prevented it from alerting when there was a problem with this avionics and the Span airplane then crashed. So that there you go for your plane flight. To
think
about that.
Exactly. The 6-hour flight back to Seattle.
But so going back, 0 day was about just indiscriminate. I want to just kill machines and cause havoc.
Right.
Trojan Horse is much more cyber and espionage, state sponsored, involves Iran, involves the U.S. So, and I finished that last summer, kind of inspired a little bit by Stuxnet, but also saying, you know, cyber and espionage in general. We had started to see this with the China attacks on Google, for example, Operation Aurora. So.
Will our heroes return?
The heroes are back.
Awesome.
And actually, they do some good butt kicking in it, too.
Yeah?
Yeah. I think this next book is it's more complex plot. The characters do some pretty cool stuff, so I think it's a lot of fun.
So what's more difficult for you? I mean, obviously, you're a techie guy, and you dig deep into some of that technical stuff. Is it sitting down, figuring out that whole character development thing, or is it sitting down, really digging into something technology that's, with 0 day, it's absolutely plausible, right? I mean, I've been in this industry a long time. I'm looking at this, I'm going, this is completely plausible in every aspect of this book. What's harder for you as you sit down to
write? Both hard in different ways, actually. The second book was harder to write than the first book, and I've started plotting the third book, which is harder than the second book. And part of the reason that it's become harder is I don't want to retread old ground. So I don't want to use the same plot devices that I've already used. So it means like, oh, I can't use kidnapping here. I can't use, you know, this. I can't use that. So
marching
how do
through
I...
the mountains of Afghanistan.
Exactly.
Right?
So I've got to come up with different ways to get things moving forward that I haven't used before. And plus I've got new scenes. I mean, the third one's going to be focused on cyber financial oriented crime, cyber crime. So I'm really kind of excited about that plot too. But it definitely gets harder. Things get more intricate when you start saying, I can't step there, I can't step there again. So I have to come up with something more creative.
It's not the same when you write the Winternals books, right?
Winternals books, that's just basically, how does this work?
Right.
Somebody else has already written the plot, right? I'm just describing.
Yeah, you're just
filling
describing
in, filling in.
Absolutely, what's going in there.
Yeah.
I'm totally sounding like a fanboy here because I really dig that. Yeah. I really.
Oh, and
particularly the end.
Yeah.
I'm like literally sitting there. I'm like just a little bit longer.
Speaking of flame, I'm doing this sysinternals hunting with malware hunting with the sysinternals tools session tomorrow afternoon here. I think it's going to actually be webcast. I think. I'm not sure.
Part of our Taste of Tech Ed, tune in.
But I've delivered that talk before at some internal sessions. I delivered a version of it at Black Hat last summer. And the closer for that, so I show real malware samples, and the closer for that last year or so has been Stuxnet. So I showed a sample of Stuxnet and I wrote this up in my blog. Actually, you can search for Stuxnet with the sysinternals tools on my blog. I did a three-parter last year on it. Now I've got a copy of Flame, so I'm going to show a quick... what the sysinternals tools tell us about Flame at the end of it. So it's kind of fun.
Is this kind of the next generation figuring out what application went wrong, now figuring out how
these kind
things
of
work?
Yeah.
Yeah. Awesome. This is a question I've always wanted to ask you. You show in a lot of your sessions kind of a few standard sysinternals tools.
Yeah.
As an IT professional, if I'm sitting at home, I might have played with one or two. What is the one or two that you say absolutely has to exist in the, I'll use the example from 0 day, in that toolbox, right? The CD that he sat
Jeff
down.
Jeff has all the systems.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Is that what he has? He has all the systems. Is there one that maybe people don't pay enough attention to, that you yourself, with as busy as you are in all these endeavors, don't have the time to sit down and go, look, this is a tool you guys really need to know?
I think most people are familiar with the big three, which I process monitor, process explorer, and auto runs. Then the next set of tools really depends on what you're after. Like in the malware troubleshooting, SigCheck is a tool, searching for looking at digital signatures on files. So there's tools like that are more focused than these other three, which are very, very general tools. I do recommend anybody that wants to learn about the tools and learn about their capabilities, a great resource. In fact, I think it's the best resource. It's called the Sysinternals Administrator's Reference, a book I co-wrote with Aaron Margosis, who's here actually delivering, I think, tomorrow a session called Sysinternals Gems, where he goes and talks about some of the tools, some of the lesser known tools as well. This is a series he's done, very highly well received.
Right.
Talk about some of the capabilities. So just check out that, his sessions on SysInternals Gems. These are all recorded, right, and going on Channel 9.
Yeah, absolutely. You'll catch them. You'll be able to view them live. Yeah.
So that and get the book. And actually, I'm doing book signings at the Tech Ed Bookstore on Wednesday and Thursday around lunchtime for all three of the books that I've got out right now. Zero Day, Windows Internals, 6th Edition Part 1, and SysInternals Admin Reference.
I could sit and talk to you. I'm not going to ask you to come back again because it's getting late in the day.
But well,
Mark,
see if
thanks
I can
for joining us.
Make time.
We'll see you in Europe. How about you come join us in Europe?
Definitely.
Sounds fantastic. Yeah. Folks, we're going to get you right back to the Learn Windows Azure event with Quentin Clark. Make sure you join us tomorrow. We're going to be doing this all over again. Keynote starts at 8:30 in the morning. That's it for us here at the Channel 9 live set at Tech Ed North America 2012. I'll see you tomorrow.